change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello and welcome to the Nonprofit Snapcast. I'm your host, Mickey Desai. My guest for today is Bill McKendry. Bill is the founder and board president of Do More Good. How are you doing, Bill?
I'm doing great. Good to be with you today. Thank you.
Yes, I've been looking forward to this interview for a long time. First, I think the most obvious question is, what is Do More Good?
Do More Good is actually a 501c3 nonprofit that was actually created to educate nonprofit organizations on the power of branding and marketing to capture and keep support for their mission, right? And so that, you know, we can get into this a little bit more, but, you know, my background in terms of, you know, working with major brands and so Do More Good really, really harnesses that power of branding and marketing. And when you think about the words do more good, it really is the more. It's the fuel to get organizations more support, you know, more attention, more awareness. And so the word more is very key because nonprofits are already doing good. And so we help them do more good.
Okay. A nonprofit marketing entity. That's, I think, a first that I've ever heard of, something like that, unless I'm just unawares. How did you come up with the idea to do
to be clear, we don't provide direct services, right?
We don't
do marketing for people. We have a whole network of members and referral sources that we can refer people to. I happen to also provide services as well. I own my own marketing firm where 50% or more of our work is with nonprofit organizations. However, you know, what we do, though, is we bring thought leaders, both from the for-profit and not-for-profit world, people that are just really excellent at communicating and marketing and branding and fundraising. And we bring that knowledge to bear for nonprofit organizations to be able to implement, right? And they can either implement it on their own using their own people, or, you know, if they're working with a designer or a small agency, or if they haven't been big enough to work with a big agency, or a bigger firm, they can, you know, be wise in what is really going to move the ball for them and help them achieve their goals and objectives that they want to achieve.
Okay. So, all right. So an educational entity then, and totally, not a direct services entity. I see. Okay. Yeah. What inspired you to do this?
So what inspired me originally to do this, I mean, there's a couple of things, pathways that inspired this. But I'll start with the clearest pathway. And is, you know, so I started my career with an ad agency called BBDO, and I worked on things like American Express and Dodge and Taco Bell. I hit a point in my career, and I was actually 33 years old. I think you're supposed to be a little older before you hit that point. In 1994, I hit halftime, you know. And so I looked at that. And I really looked at my career, and while I enjoyed it and I was very successful and got lots of awards and lots of money, I just wasn't totally fulfilled, right? Mm-hmm. And I happened to run across a guy and at the time I was working in Denver, and I ran across a guy that worked across the street from me in Denver, and his career eventually led him to Leo Burnett in Chicago. And he was working on things like McDonald's and Gatorade and Disney. We were the same age and we were very complimentary to each other. His name is Jim Hanen. And he was an art director, film director. I was a writer by trade, right? We both hit a halftime moment and we both looked at each other and said, you know, were we really made to do this, to sell tacos, to sell credit cards, to sell burgers, or were we made, you know, and could our skills be used for something even greater? Right. Mm-hmm. I'm not slamming Taco Bell or McDonald's. I mean, you know, they're in business. I get it. But we looked at what we had learned and the power, really the power of the voice of the consumer market and their ability to capture hearts and minds and attention and awareness and move people to buy what they were selling. We wondered, you know, what about the voice of human kindness? What about the voice of faith? What about the voice of charity? Could it compete better with the consumer world? And so we actually started an agency in 1994 with that thought in mind. And everybody today, you fast forward to, 2021, and the idea of starting an agency that works for causes sounds like a great business plan. But I can tell you, in 1994 was a terrible business plan. And and we almost went out of business 4 months in, And because we were way ahead of the curve. I mean, nonprofits didn't want to talk about marketing. They didn't want to talk about branding. They didn't want to look anything like a corporation, right?
Right.
But we decided that that's what they needed to do. And quite honestly, a lot of our first clients, we had to actually teach them on why this was important and their boards. And so by 1999, we were pretty successful. We were actually, in terms of the nonprofit world, we were probably the first or second largest agency in the country working with nonprofits. And it was a lot of it was what we had learned from the for-profit world. But then I was given an award in 1999 by the American Advertising Federation, brought to New York to do a speech. I was inducted into their Hall of Achievement as the best person in the country doing cause work.
Wow. So,
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. So what changed between 1994 and 1999?
We started applying what we had learned, and we had taught a lot of nonprofit organizations how to be better marketers and why branding was important and why it's such a great complement to something that they already do, which is fundraising, right? I referred to fundraising as the ground attack, mm-hmm. and marketing and branding is the air attack. Every successful company knows you need both. And every general that's fighting a war will tell you they would prefer both. Otherwise, it's Civil War style, and you're just going up to people and stabbing them one-on-one, right? But if you recognize that and what an air attack can do for fundraising, right? And that is, it just like it does in a military exercise, it softens the ground. It creates an environment for success. It lets people know you're here, right? And as a result, then, the ground troops can then come in, the environment for success is set up, and they can be a lot more successful, right? And so when I went to New York and accepted that award, I spoke, and even the president of the American Advertising Federation said, this is breakthrough stuff. Hmm. You've got to get out there and teach this, right? So they actually sent me on a speaker's tour, and I was going around the country speaking to ad clubs that were inviting nonprofit people to their events to hear me speak. And what I learned was this is really something really important. And the whole idea of saying you're already doing good, imagine if you could insert this knowledge and this wisdom into your organization and recognize that it's important, it's critically important to your mission, you'll actually be in the business of doing more good, not just doing good.
Right.
One other inspiration I'll add to that is I actually grew up with deaf parents. So sign language was my first language.
Okay.
And I was an interpreter for them in all kinds of situations from a very young age, including, going to the emergency room with my mother.
I can imagine.
Being a 12-year-old kid in the emergency room with your mom, being an interpreter, right? And so when people ask me, what's my inspiration? Well, I could say my inspiration is, we hit a halftime moment in our professional career. But in reality is, as I've looked at my life, I've always been a voice for people who need help. And that's what I see is the purpose, the grandest purpose of what somebody who does what I do could possibly do with their skills and their talent is to be a voice for people who need help and things that need help, right? And so, applying what I do to the nonprofit world to me today is not a job, it's a calling. It's something I really feel like I'm uniquely wired to do, and I love doing that.
What do you think are the biggest lessons that nonprofits need to learn in terms of their branding and marketing?
Yeah, I think I've got like five things that I typically I give seminars where I give 40 things, right?
Sure. But,
let's narrow it down. We don't have all day, right?
Right, right.
And I actually have five plus a bonus one that's a kind of a new thing that's kind of idea that's come in since COVID has started, right?
Okay. So. Yeah.
So the first thing I would tell people is there are five words I hate the most when working with nonprofits, and okay. and it is, and it's a joke among my staff, because I tell them this very early on, that when we meet with a nonprofit organization, this will come out within the first hour of meeting with them. And they're like, really? Yeah. I go, I guarantee you. And actually I reveal this in that when I speak, and I only show the first three letters or first three words. And I ask my nonprofit audiences, guess what the final two words are? And they always can, right? And the five, and it's actually technically six words that I hate the most when working with nonprofit organizations, is they always tell me within the first hour of meeting with them. And the problem is they say it with a smile, right? This is what gets, I'm an Irish guy, you know, and it doesn't take me that much to get mad, right? But I can almost reach across the table and strangle them. And they'll say this with a smile on their face. They go, you know what? We're the best kept secret.
Oh man. Yeah, no, I hate, yeah, I'm right there with you.
Right. So what I have to tell nonprofit leaders, I go, first of all, just wipe that grin off your face, right? Because I'm going to tell you why you should wipe that grin off your face. And it usually comes with this, you know, if people just knew the great work that we did and all the things that we do and stuff like that, we wouldn't even have to ask for money. They would realize how important what we do, you know, is. And then therefore they would just send us money, right? And I go, yeah. And because of your poor leadership and your poor planning and your inability to communicate well and your lack of recognition of how important communicating is, you're the best kept secret. And basically you're telling me you're incompetent in your job.
Right. I like your direct approach, because when I hear those words, I always say, this is not a virtue.
One of my funniest stories actually related to this idea was I actually earlier in my career when we got started in 1994, and for a client, a nonprofit client, we ended up being able to film and work with Mother Teresa.
Ooh, cool.
Right. And so here we are filming with Mother Teresa, 1996. She's in her 80s at this point, and so she has a handler. Right. So her handler, PR person, is another younger nun, and she's like in her 70s. Right. And so, you know, Mother Teresa comes to Washington, D.C. We have the, you know, from Calcutta, we have the ability to film her and her. I'm just shooting the breeze with her handler, a sister that's 70 something years old. And she says, you know, while we're shooting the breeze, I'm telling her about, you know, do more good and what goes on in my head and the best kept secret and how frustrating that is for me and stuff like that. And this 72-year-old nun looks at me and she goes, I get it, Bill. and I'm like, sister, I don't mean to be skeptical, but, you know, my mom doesn't even understand what I do, right? So, I mean, you know, for you to hear this from me, and then tell me that you get this. I mean, you know, I mean, I have like hardcore executive directors of major nonprofits that don't even get it, right?
Right, right.
And I go, so sister, can you just tell me how you get it? and so, because it might be helpful for me, all right? And she goes, yeah. She goes, Mother Teresa and I talk about this all the time. I go, you do? And she goes, we use a little different jargon. Mm-hmm. And I go, what's the jargon that you use? And she says, we say, no margin, no mission. Mm. I go, sister, that's way better than anything I've ever said. Man, that's like something like a Harvard MBA would say. And, you know, I go, that's fantastic. I go, can I use that when I speak? And she says, absolutely, please use it. And she said, and then she went on to explain. She goes, do you think Mother Teresa likes to leave Calcutta and go and speak around the world? She didn't even like going to get the Nobel Peace Prize. She didn't want to leave Calcutta. Right. Her heart's in Calcutta. She's with those people. She wants to help those people, those starving people. Right. And the people that are living in absolute poverty. She doesn't ever want to leave there. That's where she loves being.
Right.
But she knows she has a responsibility to leave and raise the funds that they need in order to help those people. So she leaves and she goes and she does and she public speaks. And she didn't want to do any of it. But she did, because she didn't want to be the best kept secret.
Right. I like it. No margin, no mission.
No margin, no mission.
So don't ever say we're the best kept secret. What's the next tip?
The next tip is you got to see marketing as an investment, not an expense.
Yeah.
And Peter Drucker, who was a famous writer of business books, like in the 80s and 90s before he passed away. And from what I understand, he was also responsible for, the Japanese economy. He was sent in as an expert to help Japan after World War II. And he was one of two people that are credited with creating the Japanese economy, right? But Drucker, in his early years, when he was only writing for business, he said businesses only have one and only one purpose, and that is to create a customer. If you can't create a customer, you don't have a sustainable business, right? Years later, he wrote a book on nonprofit management, and he took that same phrase and reapplied it to the nonprofit world and said, a nonprofit organization has one and only one purpose, to create a supporter. You can't create a supporter, you can't do the good that you want to do, right? Ken Caldwell is a buddy of mine. He actually spoke at our last Do More Good conference, and he's with Compassion International today, but he came out of the business world too. He used to be CEO of Papa Murphy's Pizza, and he was chief marketing officer of Domino's Pizza, chief marketing officer of Wendy's. I mean, this guy really knows his stuff. Yep. And he said, when he heard me say that Drucker quote, he said, I use something very similar, and I like his quote as well. It says, nonprofits are a conduit. They're not the cause. And it really, it's painful when I speak with nonprofit organizations and especially at conferences with a lot of executive directors. And I know this is going to take the air out of the room. And I know this is not what you want to hear, because the reason why you work for half the money that you would normally work for, the reason that gets you get out of bed every day, is probably your cause.
Yeah.
Right. But guess what? You're in charge of an organization, and your one and only one purpose to raise the money that you need to help the cause and the people and the things that you want to help. And so you're a conduit. You're not the cause. You have one and only one purpose, and that is to raise the money that you need to help the people that you want to help.
Right.
And so as a result, you have to change your mindset and say, marketing is not an expense. Marketing is an investment in making that happen.
Right. Well, and I like the way you see it. You said it, your job is to raise the money you need in order to serve the cause that you're trying to serve. Your initial job is not even serving the cause. Your initial job is to raise the money you need. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, and that's why, it's why, like, chief executive officer, just like what you see in the business world, is no longer just an executive that sits in an ivory tower. Mm-hmm. They're chief engagement officer. I mean, that's why Steve Jobs was out there introducing every Apple product that he had. He was chief engagement officer, right?
Yeah.
So an executive director or CEO of a nonprofit needs to realize that marketing is actually their responsibility. They're actually the chief marketing officer, even if they have a chief marketing officer.
Exactly.
They're the key person. Right.
Yep. Exactly. So what's the third tip?
The third tip is, you got to touch every touch point and realize that every opportunity, every connection point that you have with somebody, whether that's a volunteer or a donor or somebody that you're trying to help, every touch point matters. Right. Howard Schultz from Starbucks was interviewed about branding and marketing. And they said, can you explain to us how Starbucks became such a big brand with virtually no advertising?
Right.
I mean, they're one of the world's largest brands. And the funny story is, before Howard Schultz owned Starbucks, he used to work in an ad agency. So you would think that he would run to advertising as a solution. And he said, you don't understand branding and marketing if you think it's only about advertising. He said, every single touch point matters. Everything matters. He said, right down to the music we play in a Starbucks, to the type of cups that we hand out, to the food that we choose, or the locations that we choose. Every one of those is an ad.
No kidding. I guess that's true. Yeah.
So, I mean, I know this is a podcast, so you have to use your imagination. I always say, people who drink beverages and stuff like that, they don't pay attention to how they hold that cup, right? And they typically will hold that cup in a way that covers the logo. But I always say, people, if you watch people holding a Starbucks cup, they place their fingers at the back of the cup and they show you the Starbucks logo. just to make sure that you understand they're cool enough and rich enough to afford a Starbucks, right? and so every Starbucks cup is actually an ad or a billboard for Starbucks. You know, it's a TV, it's a live TV commercial. You're watching really cool people drinking Starbucks, right?
So my question is that how do we extrapolate that and apply that to nonprofits? You know, most
in the nonprofit world, I mean, your website, number one, is a key touch point. And you got to realize that anybody wants to know anything about you, if you call them or whatever, first thing they're going to do is call up your website, right? Make sure your house is in order and tells your story really, really well. And there's all kinds of storytelling things I could tell you, but number one, you got to realize that is a key touch point for your organization.
Sure.
It also comes down to, what does your lobby look like?
Interesting.
What do your emails look like? You know, what's the tone of voice that your people speak with? You know, what's the experience when somebody comes in contact with your organization? You know, how do people sound when they call, right? What does your social media look like, right? Does it have a personality? Is it on brand? You know, are you always looking like you really care about and you really have passion for, and you want as many people under your tent as you can possibly get, right?
Yep.
You got to think about every single touch point. And I always say, you know, that there are three possible outcomes for a touch point: positive, negative, or unrealized. And I always ask my audiences, which is the worst?
Yeah.
It's actually unrealized.
Yeah.
Because I can't tell you how many negative contacts, actually, you can turn them into very positive things. Somebody complains, thinks that you said something bad on social media or something like that. You reach out to that person, or your audience reaches out to that person and go, no, you don't understand these people. They're really good, right? And so even negative brand contacts can be made into positive brand contacts. The worst ones are the unrealized ones, the ones that just kind of like, when you sit down at night to watch TV and try to remember the next day, recall all the TV commercials you saw the night before. You probably can't recall one of them.
Yeah.
Right. And it's all this information that just flows over you and makes no difference. Doesn't make an impact at all. Right.
So any place that my nonprofit would interact with another human being is critically important.
Exactly. And say, look at your brochure, look at your website, look at your lobby, look at your emails, look at your voice, listen to your voicemails, right? Look at your social media and say, every one of these is an opportunity to move our brand forward with this person. How do I maximize that?
Well, what if I'm a soup kitchen or something? You know, I understand how to make all my materials, relevant to my donors, my supporters. But what about the people that I serve? What about those stakeholders? When I'm actually doing the thing in a soup kitchen, how do I make those touch points meaningful to the recipients?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is Ken Caldwell, who I mentioned earlier, who's at Compassion International, he's considered Mr. Innovative, right? And he said, you know, in the business world, it's really easy. You just have to be customer-centric, right? If you're customer-centric and you make the customer happy, customers are happy, they give you more business, the franchisees are happy, the CEO of the company is happy, the stockholders are happy, right? Because you just need to be customer-centric. You got to delight the heck out of the customer. The nonprofit world, he said, it's a little more complicated because you have people who you're trying to help, you know, users of your services. You have people who volunteer, and then you have donors. So, you know, it's confusing in the nonprofit world because you think that you have three customers. He's flipped their model at Compassion International and said, we only have one customer.
Hmm.
And everybody's like, who's our customer? He said, our neighbor.
Yeah.
We need to start looking at everybody as our neighbor. Sometimes our neighbor has the capacity to give money. Sometimes our neighbor has the capacity to give their time. Sometimes our neighbor is in need. And sometimes those people will switch places on you. The neighbor who once could give you money may actually be the person that becomes in need. So you never look at any of these people any differently than you would look at one of your neighbors. And so if you become neighbor-centric and you treat everybody as your neighbor,
I get it.
You know, one of the things that a personal experience that I had, and I don't want to get religious on everybody, but it was interesting because we early on and when I started my agency, our first client was actually a rescue mission. Hmm. And we decided that one day the whole staff was going to go down there. We were going to work the soup kitchen. Mm-hmm. Right. And my head of human resources, when we got there, they trained us on how to, you know, serve the food and all that other stuff. And just before they told us the homeless people were going to start walking in, she goes, I'll be right back. And she ran to the restroom and she put on lipstick and she fixed up her hair. And then she came back, and I said to her, I go, these are homeless people. You didn't know, need to go put on lipstick and you know, straighten your hair out. She said, yeah, but I don't know who I want to impress these people, because one of them might have the heart of Jesus, right? And so her motivation was, I don't know if I'm going to meet a fellow Christian as they're walking through the soup kitchen who just happens to be down on their luck. Sure. I want to make a good impression on that person. Right. I want to treat them with respect, right? So her motivation was religion. I don't care what your motivation is. Yeah. Your motivation should be treat everybody like your neighbor.
Right.
And you'll be successful.
Right. Yep. No, that makes way too much sense. I'm looking at tip number four, just to move our agenda along a little bit here.
Tip number four is, you know, you've heard Simon Sinek. I mean, everybody will probably roll their eyes when I bring up, you know, start with why, right? You know, I've heard it too many times, you know, it's sure. like, you cut it out, you know, but I like to give some practical advice, because, you know, start with why is sometimes is like, you know, kind of esoteric. How do I start with why, right?
Right.
And I would tell you, from a communication standpoint, the easiest way to start with why is stop talking about what you offer and provide and start talking about what you mean.
Huh.
So if you,
because we're trained, you know, as nonprofits to talk about exactly why we exist, and why we exist is often stated in what we do for our end recipients, right?
Exactly. So, you know, I have no problem with following up with the impact that you make and the number of people or whatever it is that you serve, or number of trees that you plant in a year or whatever.
Yep.
But don't start with that, right? Okay. There's something bigger. And what you mean possibly is, if we didn't do this, there would be more abused women and children in our community. If we didn't do this, the environment would be a mess. If we didn't do this, people would go hungry, right? That's what you really mean. Now that you have my heart and realize, man, if you didn't do what you did, people would get abused. The environment would be a mess and people would go hungry and thirsty. Tell me more, right? Tell me how you do that. You know, how you do that uniquely and how many you serve, and give me some facts. But you got to open the door with people by opening their hearts.
Yeah.
You know, some accountants and stuff like that may be moved by numbers. Most people are not, you know. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you're bragging if you start with numbers.
Right.
But if you start with your passion and your compassion and the difference that you're making first, now you've opened my heart, right?
Right.
We had another speaker a couple of years ago at the DuBois Good Conference, Jimmy Smith, who does advertising and marketing for Nike and Gatorade. And like LeBron James, Steph Curry, Colin Kaepernick will not do a commercial without Jimmy Smith.
Wow.
Right? His whole presentation wasn't just start with why. His whole presentation was, how big is your why, right? How big is it? How impactful is it? How, you know, what is the big difference that you make in a community or an org, you know, or in the country or a continent, right?
Right?
How big is your why, right? And also he ended his presentation with, and I told him, I'm going to steal both of these things from you, right? So I'm going to go, man, I'm going to be talking about pushing people to say, how big is your why? Right. And then he talked about how, you know, he had been working his entire career on trying to bring even good into for-profit things. Right. And he was always trying to steer a lot of the brands that he worked with to do good things. Right. Yeah. But he faced a lot of barriers of that, you know, they didn't want to do that because they just want to sell. Right. He also faced barriers because he's African-American. He even faced barriers getting a job. Right. As an African-American. Right. And he faced barriers as a young person with the Ku Klux Klan showing up on his parents' doorstep and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so he shared very personal stories of why he wants to do good. And then he did the mic drop moment at the end of his presentation. And he looked at our audience and he said, so this is the Do More Good Conference. I just told you about all the barriers I had to try to do more good. I'm just going to ask you one question. How bad do you want to do good? You know, then he... you know, drops the mic and and then I look at him, I go, that's why he writes Nike ads. You know, the dude can come up with just zingers, right? You know, so move from what you offer and provide and start with what you mean. The next two tips will go really fast, all right?
Okay.
So the next one is, I always end every presentation I give with this point. because I'm usually telling about strategy and messaging and research and storytelling and, you know, all these tips, you know, on how to be stronger, better marketers.
Right. But
then I get to the end and I go, if you only get one thing out of what I say today, this is the thing. And I hate to say it because it's the one thing that's guaranteed to work.
Oh, okay.
Actually, everything I told you today might work. Depends on if you get the right people at the right time and say the right thing and stuff like that. This thing works, period. And everybody's always on the edge of their seat. I say it, and it's two words.
Yep.
Frequency wins.
Right.
P.T. Barnum was famous for his, he was one of the first people to realize, you know, the P.T. Barnum circus, right? You know,
yes.
He was one of the first guys to realize that even bad PR is good PR, right?
Right.
And he used to tell reporters, he said, I don't care what you say about me, just spell my name right. because he realized the more people talked about the P.T. Barnum circus, it sold tickets, right? And it was a big spectacle, you know? And so I would just encourage people, you know, you can't talk to people frequently enough. I mean, I have nonprofit organizations say, well, we already sent one email out this week. I go, I've received like seven this week from Pottery Barn.
Right.
Yeah, I'd rather receive seven from you. You know, and it's like, you know, that you do not realize that, you know, people are exposed to 20,000 messages a day. When I graduated from college, people were exposed to 2,000 messages a day.
Yeah.
The rule of thumb was you had to reach people three times with a message before they understood you once. Today, it's nine times.
Wow.
There's no possible way that you could communicate frequently enough. But the biggest challenge I always ask people is just look at the consumer world and realize, I'm going to ask you a few questions. Is McDonald's the best food you ever ate in your entire life? Chances are you'd say no, right?
Yeah, no.
Is Walmart the best store you've ever stepped foot in your entire life? And for you beer drinkers out there, is Budweiser the best beer that you've ever had in your entire life? Well, I can tell you, every one of those brands that I just mentioned sell significantly more than their competitors because they understand frequency wins.
So even if you don't, I'm going to paint a metaphor here. Every tip we've talked about so far in my mind is sharpening the pencil.
Absolutely.
You know, and you know, you avoid, get the message right. Make sure that every element of human contact is the way it ought to be. But all of those are, in my mind, are sharpening the pencil. This particular tip, frequency wins, says to me, you simply now have to use the pencil.
Yeah, you have to put that message in the marketplace, and you have to put it, you know, out there as often as you possibly can. Having one banquet a year, having one golf outing a year, having one, you know, one news story or one mailer or, you know, one email this week, it's not enough. It's just not enough. Frequency wins. And you don't have to worry about, there are going to be some people who will say, stop contacting me. Stop sending me so much stuff. Okay, fine. I will.
Yeah. Well, which leads me to a question though, is there a point where too much is too much?
It's impossible.
Okay.
It's totally impossible. I don't know, quite honestly, of a nonprofit organization that has the budget to have too much frequency. You know, perfect example of that. That one of the stories that I use is who's the guy that owns Berkshire Hathaway?
Warren Buffett. Yeah,
Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett owns Berkshire Hathaway, but he also owns lots of brands that we all are familiar with. One that he happens to own is Geico. So he's interviewed in the Wall Street Journal about the success of Geico. They've become one of the second largest insurance company in the world,
mm-hmm.
right? And he's being interviewed by the Wall Street Journal, and they ask him, you know, how did you do this? He goes, it's really easy, advertising. And she goes, and the journalist that was interviewing said, yeah, by the way, man, how much do you spend on advertising and marketing? And he says, $2
billion. Whoa.
And she said to him, she goes, man, isn't that excessive? I love his answer. He goes, no, it's only 6% of sales.
That's just mind blowing, you know?
Right. And then the next question is, she says, well, how are you going to continue this growth? And he said, I don't know. He said, because I've run out of places to advertise. I actually was reading the Wall Street Journal and the next day I had to drive to Chicago, and that answer really bothered me. And I don't know if you've ever driven from Michigan to Chicago. You have to take this this beautiful road called the Skyway, which is, I'm being very facetious, you have to drive through, you know, Gary and Hammond, Indiana, with all the steel mills. And you have to actually plug your nose because the air is so bad on this stretch of highway, right? And I was thinking about his answer, and I'm like, you know, after my meeting in Chicago, I might drive to Omaha and try to get a meeting with Warren Buffett, because I can think of a few places that he can advertise, right? But you have to go through three toll booths on the way to Chicago. And I've known this. I've driven this route. And I will tell you, I've been all over this country. This is the ugliest stretch of highway in the entire world, right? And it is not pleasant at all. And you have to go through toll booths that overcharge you to be on the ugliest road in America. And I'm still thinking about, you know, I think fantasizing, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to go get a meeting with Warren Buffett and show him the light that I know of a few places that he can still advertise. And I go through the first toll booth and I put in my money, and something kind of registers. And I get to the second toll booth, something kind of registers, and I get to the third toll booth, and finally frequency wins. And I realize every single toll booth on the ugliest stretch of highway is wrapped by the Geico Gecko. And I go, he's run out of places to average. I'll give him that, right? But he understands frequency wins, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Frequency wins. You mentioned the bonus tip a moment ago.
Yeah, the bonus tip is, and I love this bonus tip because this is since the COVID era. This is something I heard about as COVID started. I thought about it and I started implementing it. And it may be like my last point. Frequency wins may be, you know, my best piece of advice. This piece of advice will give it a run for the money. And I've actually been told since I gave people this advice that it's even better than frequency wins.
Hmm. Interesting. What's better than frequency wins?
So I heard this guy talk about his book, and I was not interested in this book at all. Don't buy this book. It's not a good book, right?
Okay.
this guy's from Australia, and he wrote this one of these crazy books about marketing, and the name of the book is Sell Like Crazy. And he's like one of these really hyper marketing guys that promises, you know, 10 times your impact, and, you know, I'll tell you this, and I'll tell you this, and you'll buy this book, you'll be a multi-billionaire right by the time you finish, you know, the last chapter.
Right.
And so but while he's trying to sell this book, and I bought the book because I thought this story was in the book, but it's not even in the book. But he says his observation is brands are either candy, vitamins, or painkillers, and that you have to really work hard to become a painkiller if you're not already one. And he didn't say anything more. And so I was like, I gotta buy this book, man. That is a phenomenal idea, you know. So I buy the book, I read the whole stupid book, and this not even in there. So don't buy the book. This story is not in there. So then I had to make my own story. And I was like, I go, why does that resonate with me? Right. And then I started thinking about the nonprofit world. And it's hard to think that the nonprofit world actually has candy brands, but we do. Because I've talked with them. They're theater companies, they're music venues, right? Performing arts organizations, right? Right. And they don't like being called candy, but when I talk with them, they realize they are a candy brand. They're not like hyper essential. They're a beautiful thing to do and support. And they taste really good and they feel really good when you're experiencing them. But it's not life or death. Right. And so, especially in the COVID era, those are the brands, the nonprofit brands that have actually struggled the most because they are candy brands, right? They're not essential. Most nonprofits, I would argue, fall in the vitamin category. Like, that would be a really good thing to support. It is life enhancing and really good for us. But, you know, if no one's dying today, it's not essential.
Right.
So I would say most nonprofits fall in the vitamin brand category, right? There are very few nonprofit organizations like healthcare, like today during COVID. You know, if you're providing any kind of level of healthcare, COVID care, stuff like that, we're in a critical moment, right?
Right.
That's life or death. You're a painkiller at that point. So my challenge has been with clients when I meet with them today, let's look at your messaging. Let's look at your offering. And let's figure out if we can move you from candy to vitamin, at least, or if we can't move you from candy to painkiller, and if you're a vitamin, can I move you from vitamin to painkiller? Let's try to get everybody to understand painkiller, right?
Right, right.
Give you some examples. A trail organization that's actually a member of Do More Good. They asked me, how does this apply, right? Mm-hmm. So I said, you're a trail organization, right? Not life or death. You're a candy brand, right? In this COVID world, people are getting out, and sometimes their only escape is to go on a trail because they can't connect with people, but they're going insane inside the house, and so they go out and they walk the trails. Well, this organization maintains those trails, and if you don't maintain those trails, limbs actually can fall from trees and kill people.
Right, exactly. Right? Very bad when that happens. Yes.
So what you need to move from is, in this COVID world, trails have actually become an escape, a haven for people that they really need. And if they're not safe to walk on, now that's a painkiller message.
Exactly.
I had a theater company come to me and say, you know, what's our painkiller message? It's like, you can't sell tickets. You can't put on anything, right? You know, so, you know, what's your painkiller message is, if you want artists to be performing again post-COVID, can you please give us some money to support the artists until we can meet again? That's your painkiller message, because guess what? If we don't support these artists, they're not going to be here after COVID. And this theater is not going to be here after COVID. And normalcy isn't going to return if we don't support this, right?
Right.
I could tell you, even I work with an organization that works with the deaf, and they normally bring the gospel to the deaf worldwide. There's 700 different sign languages, right? And for worldwide, deaf people are, you know, a lot different than deaf people in North America. Yep. Deaf people worldwide are 90% of them are functionally illiterate. So giving them a Bible, even in their own language, doesn't work, right? So they have to do video Bibles using sign language, right? And that's what their whole mission is to spread the gospel, right? COVID comes, you know, and that, you know, that's a I would call them a vitamin brand. It'd be nice, you know, to get the gospel to deaf people.
Sure.
You know, there's other more critical things right now. Come to find out, because they've got people on the ground all over the world working with deaf groups, reports come back to them that say, you know, hey, before our message was deaf people were hungry for the word. Today, they're hungry. They're starving because of language barriers. They can't talk to people and tell people that they're starving. And so we actually have deaf peoples around the world that don't have food. And they said, but because we know who they are, and because we already have boots on the ground, we have deaf people who know these people, we could actually send them money to buy food to bring to those deaf people. And so I challenged this organization, in this COVID world, let's change our message for just a moment. Let's change what we're doing and saying, before they were hungry for the word, now they're just flat out hungry.
Right.
Language barriers are still a problem. Can you help us in this moment? So we did a test campaign, right? And we said, let's just do it for 6 weeks and let's see. Let's see how this works. 3 weeks into the campaign, I got a call from the executive director saying, turn off the campaign. I go, why? He goes, we're fully funded.
Wow.
He goes, we can't take in any more money. I feel guilty taking in more money because I don't have enough resources to actually use that money. So I don't want my donors giving me money for something we can't really use. We are fully funded.
Yep.
I've been doing this for 35 years. I've never had anybody call me and say, stop the campaign, we're fully funded. So it shows you the power of switching from a vitamin or candy brand to a painkiller, yep. How important. And I would tell you, it was probably important before COVID.
Sure.
It's probably always been important. But I could tell you, since COVID started, you got to become a painkiller.
Well, it ties back into your other tip, which is to tell people what you mean and not just why you're there.
Exactly. Right. And so, you may have to alter what you mean a little bit.
Right, right. So the five tips: avoid the five words you hate the most, which are, we're the best kept secret.
Yeah.
see marketing as an investment, not an expense. Touch every touch point with your brand. So make every single touch point relevant to who you are.
Absolutely.
Move from talking about what you offer to what you mean. And number five was, understand that frequency of messaging wins.
Absolutely.
Got it.
And then become a painkiller.
Become a painkiller. It's good stuff, Bill. If a listener wanted to be in touch with you, how would you suggest they do that?
Yeah, you can. I mean, you could go to domoregood.org and connect through the executive director there to me. If you want to go directly to me, you have to contact me at my day job, which is B McKendry, McKendry, B as in Bill, at Haven, Haven, 4 creative.com.
Got it. Thank you, Bill. This has been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed this conversation. Hope we can do it again in the future. And thanks for taking the time to make this recording with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
To our listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode. We invite you to be a part of these conversations. If you have an idea for the program or would like to be a guest on a future episode, please drop us a line via our website, nonprofitsnapcast.org. In the meantime, we'll see you with another episode in a few days.
This has been The Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.